The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So my talk will attempt to lay out broadly the revolutionary socialist approach to trade unionism, what we call the rank and file strategy. This approach, first and foremost, has to be informed by a perspective of what a trade union is, or what they are, what role they play under capitalism. So the first thing to consider is that unions are class organizations. They organize members of the working class for the sole reason that they belong to that class. That doesn't mean they'll always have the best approach, as we all know, but in an objective sense, they have enormous potential power as working class organizations. Capitalism produces two major classes that rise in relation to one another, the capitalist class and the working class, and that relation is characterized by conflict. The point of origin of capital and labor as social classes is and remains their relations at the point of production. So there's a few major conditions that define the social position of the working class. One, the need to sell one's labor power to survive. Two, exploitation or the extraction of surplus value from the workers. And three, valorization or the disciplining of the worker to keep them producing and surplus value constantly expanding. Marx also differentiated between productive and unproductive labor, workers who do produce surplus value from those who don't. The latter is particularly true among many workers today in the service sector and the public, or in the service industries of the public sector. But these workers still work for a wage, they work longer hours than it takes to produce their own income, are heavily exploited, and they're undoubtedly working class. Therefore, the working class isn't defined by income or education or status, but by these objective conditions. The blind forces of capitalism pit workers against one another in competition on the basis of skill level, race, ethnicity, gender, and so on. So one of the basic aims of a union is to resist this tendency or take workers out of competition from one another. So a union is not a revolutionary organization. Its aim is to limit the worst symptoms of capitalism without actually ending it, by resisting fragmentation within the class, raising living standards via work conditions, democratizing it to a degree from the despotic nature in the workplace. Unions are effectively reformist institutions. That being said, Marxists have always felt that unions are indispensable in fighting capitalism. They're a front line of defense against employers. Frederick Engels wrote that unions are the military school of the workers, in which they prepare themselves for the great struggle which cannot be avoided, and as schools of war, the unions are unexcelled. Now, I mean, Engels was obviously basing, I think, his observation of unions at that time on a period of much greater labor militancy, but even still, as Hal Draper writes, even in the most pacific times, the trade union movement is a school or training ground of the proletariat in a less warlike sense as well, including that of preparing cadres of workers capable of administering society. So despite the ups and downs in the class struggle, unions have the additional ability, beyond fighting for bread and butter issues, of deepening and expanding the leadership of the class among the rank and file. It was labor militancy itself, in the mass strike waves of the Great Depression era, that broke the stranglehold of unfettered business power in the era of the open shop, and legalized the rights of workers to form unions, to strike, and to collectively bargain. And this condition persisted well beyond the New Deal period until it grounded to a halt in the mid-1970s, when the period of post-war economic growth began to contract. The ruling class then began a concerted campaign to shift the balance of class forces decisively in capital's favor. This campaign included an employer's offensive, aided by both the Republican and Democratic parties to smash up the labor unions and dramatically chip away at working class living standards to recoup profit. 4 decades later, and this attack has not relented, leaving union membership at its lowest levels in a century. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the most current stats I could find, union membership is at around 11%. In the private sector, only 6.7% of workers are covered by a union contract, down from 30% in the 1950s. 35% of the public sector is organized, however, but has come under continual attacks by the ruling class. This has been most evident with teachers. And when you think about it, teachers represent the last major bastion of union density in this country, so it's really not surprising that they'd be targeted. And of course, this drop in union membership is translated into far fewer strikes. In 2014, for example, there were only 11 major strikes or lockouts involving more than 1,000 workers, compared to the 400 work stoppages per year from 1950 to 1953, and the 424 in 1974. Yet given all this, the unions still have over 15 million members of the working class organized in around 50,000 locals, with over 7 million members in the private and public sectors alike. This makes unions the only mass organizations of the working class, but also the most diverse by race, gender, and ethnicity, with women comprising nearly 50% of union membership, and Black, Latino, and Asian workers accounting for around 30%. So no matter how imperfectly they carry out their daily function or how often they concede or retreat, they're more consistently on the front line of the class struggle than any other organizations in the U.S. As Kim Moody writes, they remain the obvious place to reconnect the theory and practice of socialist politics to the only force that can fulfill that vision, the vision of those politics. And if my talk isn't very convincing, I hope the Verizon strike was. The fact that workers can organize, fight back, and defeat one of the most powerful corporations in the world in this period is a testament to the fact that our greatest power still lies in the workplace, where we can halt production and profit. The rank-and-file strategy is based on a social analysis of unions and is intimately bound up with Marx's conception or his maxim of the self-emancipation of the working class, or what Hal Draper called socialism from below, and has been informed by over a century of historical experience. It's explicitly revolutionary in nature. In other words, it shouldn't be confused with just building unions. That is, it's not an end in itself. The rank-and-file strategy is a particular approach that sets as its ultimate goal building a revolutionary party that can ultimately lead us a socialist revolution. Crucial to this strategy is the development of a distinct layer of full-time professionals inherent to a union's nature as a reformist institution. The inbuilt presumption to such a layer is that somehow the conflicting interests of capital and labor could be reconciled, which means a generalized state of compromise is sought. This scenario produces a permanent apparatus of labor officials whose job is to act as mediator between the classes, who negotiate the bargaining terms over wages, benefits, work conditions, etc. These officials occupy a somewhat unique position distinct from the rank and file. They are neither employer nor worker. Because the rank and file worker relies on selling their labor power to survive in return for a wage, their material interest is bound up with getting the maximum return on that sale. The day-in and day-out exploitation and indignities suffered in the workplace will periodically lead workers into collective confrontation with the bosses. In periods of militancy, this can even bring workers up against the very limits of capitalism itself. Not so with the labor official. Because they receive a money wage from the union, not the employer, their continued maintenance and existence with its security, power, and prestige is bound up with the preservation of the union itself, not the labor movement. This will typically engender conservatism in the official, seeing the continuation of the wage-labor-capital relationship as necessary to their preservation. This opposing social position is most evident in strikes, where the basic necessities of a worker's life hinge on the outcome, whereas the life of a union official will carry on much the same whether it's won or lost. Union leaders are often more concerned with the stability of the union apparatus than they are victory. So the limits of trade union leadership are not based on an inbuilt preference for conservative politics or passivity or other such moral arguments we often hear on the left, but a social relationship. Therefore, we also shouldn't see their role as static or one-sided. Just as there are limits to the potential radicalism of trade unions, protecting them from acting in a revolutionary way, there are also limits to the ability that the leadership can collaborate with the bosses. This is because their survival is also predicated on their ability to represent the interests of the members. Therefore, union leaders will often vacillate between the need to accommodate to employers on one hand and to challenge their priorities on the other. This vacillation will be conditioned by a set of internal and external forces. Internally, by the rank and file pressure applied from below, and externally by employer pressure applied from above. This in turn is often contingent on the nature of the period. And it's this contradictory pressure of conflicting pressures in unions that creates the potential for rank and file rebellion, which is why we adopt the rank and file strategy. Given this social and historical analysis, it's no wonder that unions have been largely engaged in defensive rearguard action for the last 40 years, where engaged at all, or have typically contractually conceded away gains previously made when labor was on a stronger footing. I'd be remiss to leave out the fact that there's been this long period of retreat has been accompanied by a self-sacrificial alliance between the union bureaucracies and the Democratic Party, where the bureaucrats, in order to save themselves and the unions from rapid destruction at the hands of far-right capitalists, have engaged in slow motion destruction by systematically making concessions to neoliberal capitalists. But even in periods like this, union leaders can take militant action on their own when necessary. We need look no further than the CWA and the IBEW and the Verizon strike. Such action as this can also have a spillover effect to other unions, even if only slightly, as it did in my union. My union is quite bureaucratic, a history of corruption, but yet the Verizon strike led my leadership with some pressure to support the strike. We donated to the strike fund, we adopted a wireless store, we protested alongside Verizon workers in the National Day of Action down at Wall Street. Another example about my union, because my union is bureaucratically concerned with shoring up their dues base, keeping the pension solvent, they'll actually organize workers. So it has the sort of the contradictory effect is it has actually has positive ancillary benefits at times. We also recently had an election in my union. We had a reform slate challenge to leadership for control of the union. They lost, but on account of that, the pressure applied. Now the leadership is actually implementing many of the reforms, you know, that the opposition wanted to implement. So I only bring that up because it shows the conflicting pressures in unions and how they're contradictory formations. The rank and file strategy is a method of trade union work that was developed by the revolutionary workers' parties in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. Across the world in this period, new forms of rank and file based worker organization were springing up to orient the changes in industry and work patterns that brought that the First World War brought about. For example, you had things like the shop stewards and workers' committee movement in Britain, the revolutionary shop stewards in Germany, factory committees in Italy, and a similar situation in France. And you had reformist union bureaucracies throughout federations in the West, including the US. Revolutionaries of different stripes, communists, syndicalists, and the like, through concerted and vigorous debate, hammered out the rank and file strategy in the newly formed Communist International, or the Comintern. Through the Comintern, the Red International of Labor Unions, or the Profintern, was formed in an attempt to organize all these disparate tendencies. So through like days on end of vigorous debate, the Bolsheviks ended up carrying this debate through figures such as Lazovsky, Zinoviev, Radek, Trotsky, and Lenin, arguing that communists and other revolutionary union militants that were won over after the revolution should implement the rank and file strategy in the mass unions. This was greatly influenced by the French CGT, where revolutionaries were basically able to take over a mass union from within, as opposed to counterposing revolutionary dual unionism. This is also why Lenin wrote Left-Wing Communism, to combat the ultra-left sensibilities among left communists and syndicalists who wished to abstain from parliamentary work and inside the reformist trade unions. Lenin wrote that socialists must organize in their trade unions, no matter how conservative their leadership or how undemocratic in practice, writing, "You must be capable of any sacrifice, of overcoming the greatest obstacles in order to carry on agitation and propaganda systematically, perseveringly, persistently, and patiently in those institutions, societies, and associations, even the most reactionary, in which proletarian or semi-proletarian masses are to be found." And so how do we carry out such a perspective? The rank and file perspective in general seeks to build a base among the most class-conscious militant workers, increase the confidence and organization of the working class, and move them into motion. It also aims to promote solidarity and class struggle, which confronts racism, sexism, homophobia, and all the other forms of oppression, and ultimately takes up political questions such as war, climate change, and imperialism. The rank and file perspective has as its ultimate goal the convincing of this radical layer that we need to build socialist organization. Any attempt to implement this approach today has to be informed by the lessons from the Marxist tradition and the theories and practice of our predecessors. It must also be informed by an analysis of the current period. And crucially, the approach has to meet workers where they're at. That means not abstaining from orienting to workers who we think don't have all the right ideas, or dissolving into the labor movement completely. The socialist organizations we belong to should be seen as our lifeline. I'm going to try to speed through some of this history here. I want to highlight the approach by running through a few examples in the U.S. in the 20th century that provide some key lessons in that, one, the Trade Union Educational League, or TOOL, which operated in the AFL, and the Trotskyist-led Communist League in the Minneapolis Teamsters. There are other examples of socialists doing union work in the U.S. There was the Socialist Labor Party before it went in ultra-left direction and it basically adopted a dual unionist approach. Hal Draper had an amusing quip about Daniel De Leon and the SLP in this period. He said, "The SLP want to build revolutionary unions, exclusively SLP unions. They're great unions," he said, "except for one problem, they don't exist." And the point being that by building revolutionary unions, which can really only ever constitute a small minority of workers in anything short of a revolutionary period, you actually isolate, wall yourself off from the mass of workers. But before the SLP had actually done this, they had worked in the Knights of Labor and the AFL. Eugene Debs' Socialist Party also had done work within the AFL. But I'll start with the tools. So in 1920, William G. Foster, who at this time identified as a syndicalist, organized the Trade Union Educational League to try and build industrial unionism, organize the unorganized within the AFL. He called this strategy Born From Within. By 1921, Foster, like many other syndicalists of his time, had been won away from his anti-party or anti-political position and joined the Communist Party, which was then called the Workers' Party in the U.S. The TOOL became the principal means by which the CP attempted to implement its rank-and-file strategy in the U.S. The tool stood for industrial unionism and independent working class politics, with the project of building a revolutionary socialist party based on the vanguard elements of the workers' movement. The tool also was unequivocally anti-racist and wished to erode all barriers to union membership based on race or nationality, fought for union democracy, and stood in solidarity with the new Soviet state that emerged from the 1917 revolution. The tool built class struggle organization in over a dozen industries, built rank and file opposition movements and united fronts with similar formations. There were no dues. They did this in part because they didn't want to be accused of dual unionism by the AFL bureaucrats. Membership was predicated on subscriptions to the national paper, the Labor Herald. The prime reason the tool had actual potential was that it attempted to reach tens of thousands of trade union militants who had previously played major roles in mass upsurges during the First World War, such as steel and meatpacking in 1919. In turn, the tool was carried out by an organization with a cadre that was steeled in struggle. The tool and its campaign for industrial unionism through the amalgamation of craft unions was able to get thousands of resolutions passed in local unions, state federations, and internationals, although it had a much harder time actually carrying them out in practice. They also brought the union locals they'd won over into the movement for a labor party at the time, which they worked on in coalition with John Fitzpatrick, the Chicago Federation of Labor. And at this period, the CP, when they were a revolutionary organization, seeking union office was not an end in itself. It was merely tactical. It was judged against the criteria of whether it aided in raising the class consciousness and combativity of the class. But by 1924, Kim Moody writes, the tool class-wide experiment lay in shambles. This was initially due to political mistakes committed by the CP and eventually the Stalinist degeneration of the party, which saw Moscow then carry the party through a series of zigzags. By the late 20s and early 30s, this was characterized by an ultra-left turn that saw the creation of independent red unions outside the AFL, and then a right turn towards the Popular Front during the CIO upsurge, where they played a highly contradictory role in those struggles. On the one hand, if it wasn't for the CP getting in on the early organizing drives and building locals from the bottom up, leading strikes, it's arguable the CIO would never have existed. They also carried out some of the most heroic and resolute anti-racist work in modern American history, such as their defense of the Scottsboro Boys. But ultimately, the political role of the party dictated by Moscow led them to orient to the CIO bureaucracy and Roosevelt's New Deal coalition, which helped pave the way for the post-war system of state-led industrial labor relations and bureaucratic business unionism. This orientation to the Democratic Party also precluded any sort of united front work with other radical forces and independent working class politics for the indefinite future. And how were the CP repaid for their class collaboration? They were purged from the labor movement. So by the very reformist forces they allied with. I think that's an important lesson for today. So almost all the left organizations played some kind of role in the 30s labor upsurge, such as the American Workers Party and the Toledo Auto Light Struggle, the CP and the San Francisco General Strike, the Socialist Party and the Flint Sit-Downs. As Kim Moody writes, the potential of radical rank-and-file mobilization to create a class-conscious labor movement was evident not only in the new CIO unions, but also in the old AFL, as the example of the Minneapolis Teamster shows. And I'll try to really quickly just go through this. Here, a small group of Trotskyists who were part of the Communist League totally transformed Local 574, an ossified craft union of truck drivers, into an industrial fighting union from the bottom up. Every step in this transformation involved the mobilization of the rank and file, leading to the classic 1934 Minneapolis strike. This process is described at length in Farrell Dobbs' book, Teamster Rebellion, which is an absolute must-read for socialists today. It represents a classic case of the rank and file strategy in that period. Dobbs and his fellow Trotskyists entered Local 574 by organizing their fellow unorganized workers into the union, and then systematically won over the membership to their ideas through patient argument and inaction, eventually taking over the leadership, leading strikes, and eventually organizing over the road trucking, which would eventually entail the Teamster Master Freight Agreement, pattern bargaining for the entire industry, making the Teamsters a labor powerhouse. Dobbs makes it clear in his book that capturing union office was not the initial aim. The officials were pressured to alter their policies first. They only looked to lead the union when they saw that mass support was evident. Dobbs summed up this approach writing, "The indicated tactic was to aim the workers' fire straight at the employers and catch the union bureaucrats in the middle." Dobbs also recognized that the best organizers were not necessarily professional staffers, but committed rank and filers. So in effect, each trucker became a de facto organizer. The fight was almost always a dual one against employers and union bureaucrats, but they knew the enemy was always capital. And I'll wrap up with just a couple of thoughts about today. So what does this strategy mean for us now? Given the conditions of the labor movement that I described earlier, certainly there's not a ready-made mass of radical workers who we can immediately orient to. such as in the era of the First World War, the post-depression 1930s, or the rank-and-file militancy of the 60s and 70s, the late 60s and early 70s, nor do we have a revolutionary left sufficient size and scope. But I don't by any means think that we should abandon the strategy on account of that. Certainly unions retain their importance as the vehicles of first-line defense against the bosses, and the basic social relations of capitalism haven't at all altered. U.S. history is replete with a long tradition of working-class radicalism and heroic struggle, which Sharon Smith brilliantly went through last night. It's the laws of capitalist exploitation itself that compel workers into resistance. How exactly the fight will play out, we cannot foretell, but it's the duty of the revolutionary left to prepare for those struggles by building our organizations in the here and now. That's it. Thank you.
Currently, in spite of the record profits that corporations are seeing today, workers have been placed in a defensive position, simply trying to protect previously won wages and benefits. Workers have been facing a 40 years long onslaught by employers, the like of which is without precedent. Wages during this time have remained stagnant, while corporate profits are at record highs. And as Tim already mentioned, the statistics from the Bureau of Labor, that there's about 11% rate of union membership across our country. 35% of that is in the public sector, which, as we know, is, it's 35% of all public sector workers are unionized. And as we know, under neoliberal austerity, this is one of the sectors that are most under attack for cuts and deunionization and removal of those jobs in a broad layer that is really without precedence. As that's gone on, there's been less and less of a fight back and a militant labor union to combat these attacks. In addition to this lower percentage that we see of organized workers, over half of all union members that still exist are actually concentrated in just 7 states, which are in the Northeast, the Midwest, and California. Now, when we look at labor leaders in general, they've responded to these attacks by shying away from the mass struggle and shutdowns at the point of production, and instead opted to pursue strategies which focus heavily on mobilizing members to get friendly politicians, usually Democrats, into office in order to give us a supposedly more favorable climate. The brutal attacks we've seen by right-wing governors and former labor strongholds in the Midwest, like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Indiana, in order to institute right-to-work legislation, has increased the cries of electing the lesser evil Democrats. Currently, the state of Illinois budget is being held hostage by billionaire Governor Bruce Rauner, who is demanding rollbacks of collective bargaining rights and wage protections in order to agree to any spending and funding of public services. He's basically pursuing a backdoor strategy to institute right-to-work style reforms, since he knows he can't actually get the right-to-work laws through with the legislatures that he's dealing with. Now, as we approach the presidential election of Trump versus Clinton, we're gonna hear the familiar refrains of "this is our most crucial election ever. We can't afford to lose this election." Now, this is in spite of the fact that the Clintons were the architects of NAFTA. Hillary sat on the board of Walmart, and she is, without question, the candidate of Wall Street and more. Now, within public sector unions like my own, the pull is even greater because it affords us the opportunity to vote out the bosses. And I was recently told at our state convention 2 weeks ago that, and I'm quoting here directly, "we must support the people who are going to determine our future." And I can speak for myself that these people that are getting elected in November are not going to determine my future. But this is the kind of conservatizing language that we hear from folks that run our unions. And it's not that, and they actually believe this, you know, unfortunately, because we've been attacked for so long that they've convinced themselves that this is the only way to approach it, even though this is the very strategy that's put us in this place in the first place. Now, I know we've painted a very bleak outlook of what's the terrain for socialists today when we're attempting to organize within our unions under these vicious attacks, but we do have some victories. In 2012, we saw the CTU here in Chicago. Their strike was able to turn back attacks by the employer offensive, and while it didn't necessarily make a lot of gains, it stopped an offensive against teachers' unions that you had not until that time seen in this country. So. And their strike not only benefited themselves, but it served as an inspiration to teachers throughout the country under stiff attacks. We've seen one-day strikes in Washington State, a winning strike in Seattle, as well as job actions in Detroit. We've seen public sector unions in New York and California gain back some ground in reversing previous attacks. The oil refinery workers who walked out across the country in 2014 and 2015, there were 6,500 workers. It was nationally significant, and it ended up fighting off most of the employer attacks, even though it probably had a qualitatively lower level of rank-and-file activism than, say, the CTU strike did, or the Verizon workers who just had the victorious strike in New York, as Tim also mentioned previously. When we look at this low level of struggle overall in the labor movement, we're looking at what role we as socialists within it can play in organizing, building a base of rank and file strength among the most class conscious and militant workers to increase confidence in organization and confronting the bosses, and when necessary, conservative union officials who are either unable or unwilling to stand up to the bosses. Now, there's contradictions within union leadership, and it puts them in this role as having to serve as the negotiator between the bosses and their members. And the elected union leadership tends to become distanced from the workplace struggles of the workers they represent. And they begin to see themselves as full-time administrators who sit down at the table with the boss as the negotiator. And they're oftentimes going to be directly, not going to be directly impacted by these negotiations since they're employed by the unions they represent. So, and it's interesting because very often these union leaders were put into that position precisely because of their activism or militant role when they were in the rank and file. Now, whatever militant past a union official may possess, if they're put in that role of guarding the union apparatus or being the mediator between the bosses and the workers for a long period of time, that there's going to be a habit of bureaucratic thinking that's going to creep in and it will assert itself. Now, this militant past that they have will actually serve as like street cred for them once they're in this more conservative role. They might be acting conservatively, but people are they're quick to point out this past role they had as a militant to try to keep that credibility in spite of their actions. Now, let's see. Now, there's going to be periods when the pressure from the bosses in the state are greater on union officials, and they're going to be willing to give concessions, seeing that as their only avenue for survival. At other times, the pressure from the workers or the boss may be relatively low, and that allows for the bureaucrats to have the autonomy in expressing tighter control of their position. And this isn't to say that all leaders are the same or are going to act in a homogenous fashion. And whether they are left or right wing does influence what they do, and it's of huge importance. I'm talking more broadly about the general influences that are going to influence the leader regardless of their left or right leanings. And it's an overriding fact that, in times of radical crisis, that their past as a left-wing or right-wing personal ideology is actually secondary. And they're going to have to struggle to maintain the control of their rank-and-file base with the survival of their union being their primary aim. Now, we also see that this rank-and-file struggle is what delivers the real reforms, but it also causes leaders to be ousted from their positions and the relatively privileged position they hold over the workers they represent. So they have to be careful that if the rank and file movement becomes too strong, well, it will win reforms for them. It also has the potential of endangering their own position within the union because they're seen as not being the leaders of this new reform. And a little personal anecdote in regard to union leadership seeing themselves as separate from the workers and more akin to a boss. I was in a union meeting of my local that represents about 1,800 letter carriers. We have 4 full-time officers who simply work for the union. They're no longer on the workroom floor. And they were trying to put forward resolutions to our bylaws that would increase some of their benefits and compensation, which they're already extremely well compensated, more so than an average letter carrier. And when our union president was arguing from the front, of course, about why the membership should want this great compensation for the officers, he said, well, you know, we have to sit across the table from a postmaster, and we should be compensated like postmasters. I ended up arguing against this increase of the benefits and whatnot, and I was actually glad he brought up the fact that he felt he should be compensated like a postmaster, because my response to that was, if a union official wants to be compensated like a postmaster, then they should go become a postmaster. But until that point, they're technically a letter carrier and they should be compensated as such. So we see these opportunities where we can step forward and you know, union leadership can put things like that on a platter for us. In a Marxist-Leninist tradition, we see socialists as serving as the vanguard that leads the masses to revolutionary victory. It's a vision of mass working class self-activity to end exploitation through mass action. This is the dynamic that Marx spoke of when he talked about capitalism creates its own grave diggers. To further elaborate this point, capitalism creates the conditions that then force workers into a position of fighting the oppression capitalism has placed upon them. It's incumbent upon socialists to be within this rank and file struggle and leading it. You know, in our present conditions, this is really difficult, but not impossible. Organization and politics within our unions are a key ingredient in dealing with this present situation. We must seek to build currents of rank and file groups within our unions that can withstand the pressures to capitulate to endorsing democratic politicians and concessionary bargaining. The hierarchical character of most U.S. union locals creates pressure on even reform-driven union leaders to capitulate to pressure from employers, politicians, and the state to conform to the usual top-down methods of administering and to, you know, get in line and work with us from the inside in order to get a seat at the table. You know, we acknowledge the existence of these pressures and attempt to counter them by politically conscious and active rank and file movements. There are also times when a radical in leadership will have to support a more conservative action and democratic decision of the rank and file that doesn't yet have the same consciousness that the leader does. So that is one of the contradictions of a more radical leader taking office when they don't have that rank and file that's at the same level of consciousness that they are. And Tim mentioned the Teamster Rebellion book and the strike that was led by Trotskyists in Minneapolis. And the reason they won, you know, local union office and they managed to hold it in spite of the attacks from the state bosses and their own national leadership of their union was because they had a sizable fraction of revolutionary socialists in their rank and file. And they had created an even broader layer of union membership who looked to them for leadership and would thusly defend them when they inevitably came under attacks from the state, the higher national leadership in their union, et cetera. And it took anti-communist federal prosecution to eventually have them removed from office. When we look at that 1934 strike, I think one of the best lessons we can learn from it was the fact that the governor had originally supported the union, their right to unionize, but at one point during the strike, he calls out the National Guard to break the strike because of his role in that office. He had no choice, even though he had claimed to support the strikers. And what was I saw as a key success in the strikers' lesson was the fact that when this pressure came, they had developed a strike committee that was in charge of what they would do and how they would do it once they went on strike, so that their own conservative elements in their leadership and their executive board couldn't end the strike and capitulate to the governor and the national Teamster leaders that were on them to settle it, everything had to go through this broader strike committee that was made up of rank and file activists. And so I would again say that everyone should have this book. It's the lessons throughout are just essential. And, you know, we know that unions' purpose is to fight for gains of the workers they represent, as opposed to the class as a whole. Trotsky wrote with this in regard to their function. The trade union embraces broad masses of workers at different levels. The broader these masses, the closer is the trade union to accomplishing its task. But what the organization gains in breadth, it inevitably loses in depth. Opportunist, nationalist, religious tendencies in the trade unions and their leadership express the fact that the trade unions embrace not only the vanguard, but also heavy reserves. The weak side of the unions thus comes from their strong side. So the unions are strong because they have broad masses of workers, yet it's also a weakness that not all of these workers are of the same revolutionary consciousness, or many of them are not in revolutionary consciousness at all. And so under normal conditions, the working class is far from homogenous, and it's only going to be in revolutionary upheaval that the class can achieve a common goal and common socialist consciousness. Since the mass of workers will not be consciously revolutionary until the point of revolution, do we simply sit back and bide our time until the moment is right to spring into action? You know, of course that's not what we're going to do. The task of the Marxist Party during the pre-revolutionary time is not to simply engage in propaganda and abstain from struggle. A revolution doesn't appear spontaneously, but is itself a product of class struggle. Therefore, the workers will have to fight countless limited and indirect battles against capitalism and against the system before they're ready to overthrow it. And the system itself will be weak enough by this point to finally be defeated. Equally, it's only through such struggles that the party can be built to the point where it's able to lead the revolution to a successful conclusion. This is how workers and revolutionaries will be developed until they're at the point to lead and win a revolution. The Revolutionary Party must have clear priorities and an understanding of the basic contradictions under capitalism between proletariat and bourgeoisie, and the role that the trade union bureaucracy plays between the two. Now, I would say that it's important to understand that unions are accepting the framework set by the system of capitalism, and they tend either to exclude political issues from discussion in order to preserve unity, and or they will support reformist politicians that don't challenge the present order of class society. And I think even coming out of the 2012 CTU strike, we saw that happen within their union, where they had a turn to a Democratic election and supported a Chuy Garcia candidate who said that, you know, unions were going to have to be prepared for like some tough medicine, and that he told them, I'm going to disappoint you. Yet, you know, that's how even in a more militant union, that membership was still in this reformist politician is going to save us idea. And there was also a great debate within the CTU to support the Black Lives Matter demonstrations on Black Friday, that the fact that it would be divisive and that, you know, that CTU would be seen as anti-cop if they stood up and said that it's wrong to murder Black children in the city of Chicago. Ultimately, a revolutionary party puts emphasis on the activity of union members, and it consistently adheres to the idea that the working class cannot change society unless it changes itself in the struggle. This is how socialism will come from below. It doesn't mean the party doesn't fight for changes in the personnel of the union officialdom either. One cannot simply denounce the leadership unless one is ready to challenge it and replace it. But when a revolutionary runs for office in a union, a clear and definite rule must apply that doing so assists the activity of the rank and file or removes obstacles to doing so. Union office does not substitute for this activity. running for any union position, whether it's shop steward or full-time officer, one must ask if it raises the possibility of increasing the level of combativity of the workers that one represents. No matter if a union is run by a revolutionary or a left official, if a party is to support the struggle for election of any official, this work should supplement and not supplant the activity of the workers. Elections and unions should seek to enhance the power of the rank and file, not substitute for it. And I want to close with another quote from Trotsky, which I think well encapsulates this idea. He says, "With the masses, always. With the vacillating leaders, sometimes. But only so long as they stand at the head of the masses. It's necessary to make use of vacillating leaders while the masses are pushing them ahead, without for a moment abandoning criticism of these leaders."
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.